New York City during the 1970s was a beautiful, ravaged slag. Impoverished and neglected after suffering from decades of abuse and battery. She stunk of sewage, sex, rotting fish, and old diapers. She leaked from every pore. No Wave was the waste product of Taxi Driver, Times Square, The Son of Sam, the blackout of 77, a desperate need to violently rebel against the complacency of a zombie nation dumbed down by sitcoms and disco. We were howling with delight, laughing like lunatics in the madhouse that was New York City. Thrilled to be rubbing up against the freaks and other outcasts who somehow, for some unknowable reason, had all decided to run to Land's End and, all at once, scream their bloody heads off.
I took a walk through this beautiful world. Felt the cool rain on my shoulder. Found something good in this beautiful world. I felt the rain getting colder. Sha-la-la-la-la. Sha-la-la-la-la-la. Sha.
But a bunch of crackheads, dope fiends, and motherfuckers.
This is a show about a very special place, a very special time, and some very special people. So much happened. So much began on New York's Lower East Side.
Those buildings are still there.
You know this neighborhood from the dope cops.
Yeah, right? All of them. I mean, I know every corner, every ground. By order of, like, preference, you know, because there was some, you know, you'd really rather not to go to. That was, like, sort of, like, you know, last resort.
Yeah.
Somewhere, there was a big hole in a wall right there. Basically, like, a car-sized hole in a wall. You'd step into an abandoned space. I didn't know any spots down there. I mean, people would take me, of course,
yeah.
But it was not my regular.
Yeah.
My regular was here at Executive in Laredo, where my preferred. But for a while, I had to go specifically to me.
Yeah.
The Lower East Side was in many ways the cradle of New York. The Lower East Side was in many ways the cradle of New York, where new arrivals first settled, built communities, and later moved on, only to be replaced by others. In the New York City of the 70s, nearly bankrupt, riddled with corruption, the Lower East Side, particularly Alphabet City, was left to fend for itself. Huge swaths of it abandoned, ruined, or simply empty. Much of it became an open-air supermarket for drugs, whole blocks taken over by organized drug gangs. Rents were cheap, and the neighborhood started to attract a newer, highly energized and creative group of people who wanted to make things. Music, poetry, movies, and art. It seemed, at the time, everybody was a star. And for a while, at least, that it was a golden time. But it was dangerous. You lived down here, you had to be tough and talented, and often, very quick. Now, things are different. Very different.
Everybody together, ready? One, two, three. Pick those feet up 6 inches and hold. Bring that arm over, pin the wrist, let's go. Is everybody clear?
Yeah.
I can't hear you.
Yeah.
Okay, on three, one, two, three, let's go. I mean, this is pretty much some of the last remnants of what the Lower East Side kind of used to be like, you know? Good old school, no elevator.
So you didn't live in this building?
No, this wasn't the building I lived in. This is a squat, though, that actually became legal. I was actually in that building right there. When I lived in it, it was, you know, we had no windows, no front doors. You know, you'd find a door in the street, you'd put it up and chain it up yourself, you know. No running water. I used to bathe in the fire hydrant in front of the building, and I used to sleep with my pit bull so rats wouldn't get too close to me at night, right. You know.
You actually grew up here. What was that like growing up here, being a little kid here?
My main problem growing up down here was that I lived on a gang block.
Right.
The gang on my block was called the Hitmen. And, you know, they were no joke, right? And I remember they would be hanging out on the stoop on the church across the street, smoking dust, all of them with their golf clubs and 007 knives, and everybody would be listening to, of all things, Kraftwerk,
right.
Trans-Euro Express.
Right.
They'd be out there screaming, "We're gonna kill the next that comes out of that building." And I'm laying there. Thinking, wow, I gotta go to school tomorrow, man. I was never a violent person. You know, Christ, I was raised by hippies. But I was thrown into a crazy environment where I had no choice but to fight my way through it. I always had a cue ball and a sock in my pocket. I'd split your head open quicker than you could say, "What the?" And it did turn me into a bit of a problem as a teenager, you know?
I would guess. Wait a minute, I don't have to guess. I know. First time I saw you, you were famously that 12-year-old drummer in the Stimulators. Your aunt was in the band.
Yeah. That was the only reason we were allowed to play at most of the clubs, is because I had a relative who was basically my legal guardian. I need to get a vanilla egg cream. What are you getting?
Chocolate egg cream.
Chocolate please. Egg cream.
Yeah, one vanilla, one chocolate.
I got PTSD, man. It's like, I just feel like I'm seeing ghosts when I'm down here, man. I miss it, though. I'll tell you, as much as I paint it as this horror story, which it was, I loved it. You know, it'll always be a part of who I am. My man.
Cheers.
Right, Ray. Yeah. Thanks for the egg cream.
That is a superb egg cream.
They don't make them no better.
You like something about what?
I had a signed the last words of Dutch Schultz.
Be out of it.
You came here first as a writer, as a poet. New York, in your mind, was where the writer's life was?
Yeah, well, it was just the place that had the most stimulation.
Was music even in the back of your head, or was poetry and writing?
My model was Dylan Thomas there when I was a teenager. You know, so being a drunken womanizer, that was my ambition.
I woke up in your own lifetime, opened up a paper, and realized there's like a million kids in Britain dressing like me and cutting their hair like me. And you have this inadvertent tectonic effect on kids all over the world.
It wasn't inadvertent, but it was indirect. I mean, I wanted to have that effect. Other bands who responded to the way I was doing things got famous. So it ended up having this huge impact and influence. When I first saw a picture of the Sex Pistols, it was like, I just had to laugh.
That's a charitable interpretation of events. Malcolm McLaren came to New York and saw the Voidoids and went back and built a boy band and said, you're going to dress like that guy.
Yeah, I don't really look at it that way.
Look at it.
Yeah.
All right.
I mean, ideas are free. I never resented that. Mm-hmm. But it was funny and strange.
Cheap Rent brought a lot of people together. It wasn't just living spaces were cheap. There were venues where you could put whatever it was you did out there.
CBGBs didn't exist until we created it. I mean, we went and proposed that we be the house band there.
The thrilling, isn't that number is called I Belong to the Black Generation.
And then your band, the Voidoids, what were your expectations?
I wanted everything that anybody starts a band wants, but I didn't even quite realize how weird and uncommercial I was. I thought what I was doing was really catchy.
Do we over-romanticize that period? Was it special?
I think the creation of the mythology of the 70s kind of began in the mid-90s. I can see why people who weren't there wish they were there, but it goes against all my instincts to think that way, just because the idea is we didn't like what things were, so we decided to change them.
Why are you here tonight?
I guess we're just interested to see what's going on. We saw a bit in, I think it was New Yorker, and more or less thought we'd see what was happening. Simple as that.
How about you?
It's a fascinating place, I must say. It's probably one of the most interesting places in New York. Just simply the neon lights and the crowd here. It's all very interesting.
Would you come here again?
No.
Have you ever considered writing a dishy memoir? I mean, my God, it would be 800 pages long.
You know why? Because so many people are still alive.
I mean, people love you.
Yeah, they have to say that. How can you say something mean about somebody who might be mean back at you?
It's an industry. Are you kidding me?
What was it like the first time you saw Iggy? And I didn't see him. I heard the music from down the hall. I mean, I thought, this is the rock and roll. I always wanted to hear something that was this fierce, and yet you could sense there was a tune there.
When I bought Funhouse in high school, I was immediately ostracized.
Yeah.
This was defining music, and normal people didn't like it.
The Ramones met because they were four outcasts in a high school with 5,000 people who liked Funhouse.
Right.
Okay? They had it all figured out, that they would sell as many records as the great record sellers would sell. And in a few years, they would have so much money that they would retire and never have to work again.
Right. Especially with each other.
Guess what? They had to stay on the road for another...
25 years.
Yes. Do you know where the greatest financial success has come from? Hey Ho, Let's Go.
Right.
Sung in football and soccer stadiums around the world. The Ramones estates are gathering in more money from 5 seconds than they ever made in the... Is that the measure of greatness or eternity? It's one of them.
so many people died. So many people didn't get recognized. Yeah. Richard Hill still living in the same apartment he lived in 40 years ago.
Who likes to move in New York? He got a good deal. The neighborhood got all better around him, you know. Iggy was supposed to be the one who didn't make it most of all. And he's still there, the most dangerous. God sends us these signs that there are miracles. Don't give up hope. What you believe is beautiful probably is, but not everyone will know it in time.
This podcast is supported by Sleep Number. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores? Sleep Number does that. Only Sleep Number Smart Beds let you each choose your ideal comfort and support, your Sleep Number setting. Sleep Number Smart Beds learn how you sleep and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. Temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent. This week on Chasing Life...
I'm sorry that the Great Barrier Reef is no longer great, that we value Amazon much more than the Amazon, and that the waterfront neighborhood where you were growing up could be condemned by rising seas before you're old enough to apply for a mortgage.
That's my friend Bill Weir, CNN's chief climate correspondent. He's optimistic about the planet, and he's optimistic about our ability to take care of it. Listen to Chasing Life, wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, my name's Hugh Mackey. Moved over here in 81 and started this shop in 86. When we opened this shop here, we were the only, like, business on the block. We were the only, like, real thing apart from just mayhem down here. Basically, it's been a one-man show with one person helping me, and we still fix old British bikes. We're really into it, but nowadays, there aren't so many people into it anymore, and the supply of bikes is dwindling. It's gotten to the point now where I'm the only bad thing on the block. I'm now the mess, I'm now the noise, I'm the scruffy building. It's not that anymore. It's just not. I mean, it's super expensive restaurants which come and go every 5 years. High-heeled girls with mink coats on getting in fancy schnitzel restaurants, and they're standing on rats, and they think that's cool. What they don't know is that before the restaurants were here, there were no rats. So now all these, like, rich people are coming down here and standing on rats and think that's East Village, and it never was, you know. So...
If you're coming to New York, a section of New York that's completely broke, you are broke. You're going to be an artist, and not just art, but fairly confrontational. How committed do you have to be to do that, particularly at that time?
I think that, contrarily, it hasn't been that hard. I feel like I've been very fortunate to have got to stay alive here. So, and I have everything I need. Look around us. It's a wonderful amusement park of good and bad ideas all happening at once. You know how people immigrate here to start a new life and to dream big? I felt like I needed to do that as well, just like the way the people did at the turn of the century. You moved to New York to immigrate to a new land to start a new life. And that's really what the Lower East Side is all about. You know, it was an extremely rare and wonderful time. I think only now do I realize how fortunate I was that I got to experience a neighborhood that had Jack Smith on First Avenue, that had the Living Theater, that had Jonas Mekas on Second Street.
Who thrilled you back then? Who was doing stuff that you just thought, holy shit, this is really incredible and inspiring?
Luckily, my friends that I was working with were very inspiring. I loved Joe Coleman's work.
The Lower East Side at that time was a destination for me. There was something, you know, that compelled me, you know, to just be there. And I would paint it. Squeeze in.
Yeah. Wow. Wow. Oh, yes, you were telling me about this guy.
Yeah. And here, if you want to use this.
It's beautiful.
You know, all the paintings are novels, you know, so it's a dense story, and the more that you look, the more that you learn. And it's in non-linear time, you know, like you're exploring, you know, at your own pace, whatever you want to look at, and someone else might start in a different place, and, you know, it might tell a different story.
The performance art, at what point you came to paint, or did you come to paint?
No, I came to paint, but the paintings were like implosions where I was studying the world around me and myself inside, and the performances became literal explosions. I learned violence from my old man, so I was angry. You know, when your house is on fire, you know, you don't read poetry and you don't, you know, sing a folk song. You know, you gotta scream.
I missed all the great art at the time. I came for heroin. I came for music. Other than that, I didn't live here. But, man, a lot of people didn't make it. And I remember, I guess, around 1980, it was like, something is happening, and no one knows what it is.
You mean the AIDS? Yeah. A lot of that time exists in my mind like a dream, like an opium dream. I have these people that I love that would just, like, drop out and fall out. I'm a little bit sad that I wasn't there. I wasn't present, you know, for them, because I was too off in this other world. But for me, it was still something of great beauty. See, that time, you have Wall Street tycoons fighting for huge amounts of wealth, and you have, like, bums, you know, fighting over, like, pennies, and it has like a primal, like, awe.
We're bus over, matzah pry, special matzah, special days.
Yes, sir.
I've been coming here since 1966.
Over 50 years.
45 years.
It's family.
So everyone should come, but not too many people.
Places like Keith Haring and I would love to come here. Jean-Michel would join us, and we would have good meals here on a regular. And it was consistently the exact, you know, it's great when you can go to some place, they have the exact same food. Come on, this
still
is
the
it.
Same?
Still exactly the same.
That's encouraging.
Which is great. It's great. I mean, you know, even though there's a hotel three doors away
right.
and high rises going up, you can still have a decent meal.
You brought hip-hop culture to a very finite number of people
yeah.
initially on the Lower East Side.
Mm-hmm.
Totally changed the world.
Everybody gets some day. Everybody gets some day.
Teenagers at that time were doing something interesting, so I wanted to find some people that would listen to these ideas. And that's what led me to the Lower East Side and to connect with.
I guess you met Glenn O'Brien.
Glenn O'Brien, yeah. Glenn was key to it all, because I would read his column in Interview Magazine. It was just brilliant. And I met him, and he embraced me and invited me to be a part of TV Party, which was this underground.
Oh, I remember it well. I watched it at the time.
Hi, and welcome to TV Party.
Fred. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what the Holy Land looks like?
I want you to know that I've been to the Holy Land. And the Holy Land is so funky. It's funky, Bella. It's funky.
And through that connection is where I met all these people that listened to all these ideas I had. And that was David Byrne, Chris Stein, and Debbie Harry, and so many amazing people that were just like, yeah, tell me more.
I go through this wall, I go through this grid, man, but I'm going through it in the north end, and so many things that I want.
What I think is under-celebrated about you guys in particular was your kindness. You were famously really, really supportive of the people you came up with, your contemporaries, the people
yeah.
around you who weren't doing as well, you know, let each other sleep
well,
on each other's
floors. Well, there was nothing at stake.
There was nothing,
at stake.
And I mean this in a good way. You were writing hits from the beginning. I mean, these are enduring songs that people are still listening to and hold up. I just think a lot of people had low expectations. You didn't. I mean, you had a plan.
Well,
yes.
No, if we had a plan, we would have made more money and not got so completely over
yeah.
by the industry, as it
we
were.
We had a plan
know?
To survive.
Yeah, I mean,
we had a plan
ongoing.
To keep going doggedly. And I think the thing that was so attractive about that period was you weren't locked in to one format or one form, you know? It was just, everybody was doing everything.
You introduced the entirely revolutionary notion that street art was in fact really art.
The painting that we did on the street was coming from a place that pop art came from as well, like popular culture, magazines, advertising, comics. And so some of the first people to buy paintings from me and Jean-Michel was Chris and Debbie from Blondie. And then they also commissioned me, Lee Quiñones, and Jean-Michel to do sets and art and participate in their music videos, some of the very first.
Your support and work with Fab Five Freddy, I mean, look at the soundtrack to the whole world now. It's hip-hop. That connection, that crossover there, you got to put considerable muscle and gravitas.
I talked to all these record company guys, and I'd say 98% of them told me it was a fad.
It's not going to last.
It's going to go away in 5 years.
And you recorded a song that was hugely...
Well, I will say, you know, like, I'm very proud of the fact that, you know, we created a format that didn't exist in rap until then, and that is that we wrote a song that had a rap in it.
Yeah, those guys were sampling stuff.
The rapping was all right. Just scratching and sampling, so we, you know, made it viably commercial.
And then, you know, yet another earth-shattering event, a Wild Stop.
I had an idea that if we could make a movie and show that this rapping, this dancing, and this DJing was one thing. So I was on a trip to Germany not long after the film had aired, and I see these kids breakdancing. I'm like, what the hell's going on? As I got closer, I noticed the moves the kids were doing were the exact same moves that the Rocksteady crew does in Wild Style. But I then knew that this was going to translate globally.
I remember that film opening, and that was a nuclear bomb. And it ended up being like the second highest grossing.
Second to Terms of Endearment, which not many people think about now, but yeah. You did
film, well. You gotta love that moment of corporate terror in the film industry when people are looking at the weekend grosses, and it's like, what's this? Who is this audience that did not appear in our metrics?
No, it was a great, great experience.
The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish. There's been a ton of writing about the album Cowboy Carter since it dropped this spring. But what grabbed my attention is a new documentary on CNN called Call Me Country, Beyoncé and Nashville's Renaissance. Lots of artists have tried to boot scoot their way onto country music charts. Why did this album cause such a stir? And what about both this pop star and this political moment has caused all this conversation? Listen to The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish, on your favorite podcast app.
I came to the Lower East Side back in 1964. When I came here, the changes was already in motion. There was the heroin epidemic, beginning of the homeless epidemic. And there I was, witnessing all these changes. That's the history of the Lower East Side. Everybody have to go back and find themselves in the Lower East Side. Probably every day or every week, just by walking through it. That's my connection to the neighborhood. That's the neighborhood connection to me. You know, to photograph that before that changed, to have that running history. My main thing now is to keep a running record. So I started the 4th Street Photo Gallery here, and it's been history ever since. I'm still here. I survived.
We'll be right back.
you started making films before you knew how to make films.
Yeah, yeah. The oddball thing about it is knowing so little, being an amateur was so helpful. Who knew that you could hire a casting director? No, it was just like, hey, you play that, you play that, you know. Hey,
which one of our friends are going to be around
exactly.
for this?
Yeah. Are you going to be around next Tuesday? Because, you know. I saw myself more as like experimental filmmaker. You know, like the Godard films, for example. They were inspiring because I could say, I could do that.
I owe a lot to Amos. No, I saw The Foreigner. It was amazing. It was the whole scene was there. Everybody was there. It was
that
really,
was a big night.
I got so charged up, and I was sure I was going to make films.
And your first film was a student film.
My first film was a student film, Permanent Vacation.
They think people like myself are crazy, you know, because of the way I live, you know.
NYU Film School made a mistake. So I had a $12,000 budget for my first film.
Which is enormous for the time.
It's huge for me. But the root of the word amateur is the love of a form. And professional means you are doing it for money. So I still hope that I consider myself an amateur, for sure.
What was the budget on your first film?
Oh, man.
$12.
Yeah. Well, it depends on what you call a first film, but Blank Generation was like 2,200. I started shooting bands, and it was more, how do you shoot music with a silent camera, basically? And then Unmade Beds was like my first narrative film. It was like about 4,000.
I think on Unmade Beds, someone from the New York Times called it the cinematic equivalent of kindergarten scribbling. And Amos put that on his posters, New York Times, and that was the most, like, punk-ass move.
So, yeah, so what do you think now when you walk around the neighborhood? You know, you paid some dues to walk down back in the day, and now it's projectile-vomiting frat boys with baseball caps on backwards. Does this give you a sinking feeling, make you angry, or
are you just resigned? I wish I would have bought real estate, that's for sure.
The thing that I always tell myself is look at the history of New York City, and it's always about hustling and
change.
And if you want it to stay the same, man, you got the wrong historical spot because there used to be a Native American trading post on the tip of Manhattan. It's now Wall Street, you know? I just don't want to go out in the streets no more. I just don't want to go out in the streets no more. Because these people, they give me the creeps anymore.
Can I enter a minute?
Yeah, sure. I'd love to take a peek. I'd be interested to look at your dope bags.
Yeah, here's some. I got this guy who was a bank robber, and he was going to jail. He hooked me up with this. This is from the 80s.
Oh, wow. Airmail. Okay, 12th Street.
Yep.
I might have a little bit more glasses on for this.
Yeah. It's a treasure.
DOA, I remember.
Poison, you must remember.
Poison, yes, of course. Evidence. You were the psycho. I remember all of those.
Did you ever do Hellraiser?
No, I don't remember ever. Toilet.
Here it is. Classic, right?
You know, you knew you were doing something bad when you bought a product called Toilet and, you know, shot it in your arm. Oh, man, memories. Yeah. I mean, basically, your reputation is the Godfather archivist of all things Lower East Side. You were here pointing your camera at stuff since the early 80s.
I probably have one of the largest inner city photograph collections of anybody. I used to know everybody that went by. And that neighborhood thing is like really important to me. So I photographed the Puerto Ricans, the Dominicans, drag queens from the Pyramid Club, basically the whole hardcore scene in 87. I was more interested, like, the eccentric people, the unique people.
tour at the Battle of Tompkins Square Park, which is sort of the Gettysburg of the Lower East Side. I remember it had essentially become clogged with nodding junkies,
right.
Homeless people who'd set up a permanent camp.
It was dangerous.
It was genuinely dangerous. When the police came down and decided to clean the park, the question is, who won?
Well, in the beginning, we did. You know, you have to remember, in 1988, they couldn't close a 10.5-acre square park in the Lower East Side. That was 450 riot cops, horses, helicopters, the whole, they couldn't do it.
Yeah, maybe we get the better city.
We don't got no weapons. They got 9mm down there. And shotguns.
There were big bonfires in the middle of Avenue A. Buses couldn't come down, cars couldn't down. It was stuck.
You were on the news a lot, I remember. You were the most, like, despised man in... the NYPD, yeah. you were not their favorite photographer, let's put it that way.
This went on for 4 years. There were multiple riots, hundreds of arrests. 4 years here, a real solid conflict. Cops eventually got organized. I think this was the beginning of the sort of police state mentality in America.
I remember Tompkins Square. After the police fenced it off, it was, in a lot of people's minds, the end of an era.
And yeah, when they cleared off the drugs, a lot of people think, hey, great, we're now going to have a neighborhood and everything's going to be safe. And then in came the gentrification. So the whole concept of America is being wiped out because you can't pull yourself up by the bootstraps anymore because you can't get in the game. Gentrification has affected the whole city. You have to now make a huge amount of money to be here. You know, they got skyscrapers in Midtown that are sold millions of dollars apartments and nobody lives in, and they're empty.
I live in one of those big empty buildings with absentee owners. Is that all that's going to be left in New York?
Yes. New York, there was always something that brought it back. But once you fill it with the corporate world, it's never going back. So we turned a corner that we will never go back again. And so it's over.
It's over.
It's over.
I have my eye on the octopus.
Okay, then I'm going to go straight into the...
Straight. You're going to go straight. You're finally going straight. I'm impressed. Can you verify exactly what straight means?
If I know.
No way, honey. Even when you're straight, you're not straight.
Okay. expect to make a living from your art?
No, of course not.
At no point.
I just was happy I didn't have to suck in an Iranian shoe store. First of all, I thought I would come to New York to do spoken word, but spoken word didn't really exist. So I started Teenage Jesus and the Jerks. I had to really make the most hideous yet precise din I possibly could as a tantrum against all of music and all of society.
There were a lot of freakish never could have happened at any other time. It seems to me bands who had a ready-made audience. Okay, as you did to an extent, you could basically say, I am a rock star.
Well, no, wait. Really,
I am a star.
No. And first of all, I never said I was a star.
No, but I mean not by word, but by deed and deportment.
Well, we are great, aren't we?
First of all, I'm not a star. I'm not an icon. That might be your midnight fantasies.
You walked into a club. People knew who you were.
I didn't walk into any place thinking I'm a star. I walked in thinking I had shit to do. But I wouldn't say I was a catalyst. I'd say I was a cattle prod. To get people to do shows, booking shows, curating shows, it's just what I do. It's like, let's go, let's do it. And when people would ask me to do things, I'd be like, yeah, I want to do it, of course. People were beautiful doing things because they had to do it, not because of any other grand idea.
So what made you happy back then? I mean, did you have any happy moments?
Happiness was not the goal. Satisfaction was the goal, as it still is. My anger is on a global level. It's never on a personal level. I'm very happy.
Right.
I'm happy to have octopus with you tonight, my dear. Huh. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Good?
Perfect.
Yeah.
When was the last time you had something this good in your mouth? I know you eat well, but this is like...
That's been a while. This is pretty incredible.
Why are you here tonight?
To see the Dead Boys.
Why?
Because they're great.
How do you know?
Because I f***ed them. Who do you want in the rundown, Ann?
Did you throw the,
Yeah, I did. That was my present. I'm Lunch. They do a song called I Need Lunch. I'm Lydia Lunch.
Why did you throw that? What was it?
They were used tampons. Genuinely used, new ones. Why did I give them to them? Because they're going to eat them the second set.
You were featured prominently in many of the best known films of the era.
Most of which sucked. I was trying to be a reflection of the reality at the time. This is why I made the films I made, especially with Richard Curtin.
Just drop me off. Where are you taking me anyway?
My house.
So we did this horribly violent film called Finger that was based on real things that had happened to me. It was not glamorous. It was not pretty. It was offensive, but I'm trying to work out my psychosexual problems because I know I'm not alone in them by making films and speeches that will address the situation that I know other people suffer from.
Okay, this was a film very influential, far beyond the imaginings at the time.
We didn't think that when we did it. We didn't give a shit. We just wanted to make a film and get it out there because we had to do something because we were burning. Our blood was on fire.
Looking back, though, was it all that? Was it a golden period? Are you nostalgic?
No.
I
am golden. It's always a golden period for me. Look, we have a golden piece of asparagus. It's golden.
So do you have any sense of...
No.
Oh, those are the...
I don't. Those were the bad old days, baby. You try living on pizza and black beauties. You try giving handjobs under the table to take your first band to Europe. You want to go back to that? You go back to that. How were you living? I know the same. Hand them out.
So no sentimentality, no nostalgia at all.
I'm doing too much shit all the time. I still have shit to do. Why am I boohooing when I've just been on tour from October to the next October? I'm not stopping.
Youth? Would you want to go through that again? Or is it that overrated?
Don't I look good for my age?
Shit. Oh, yeah.
Well, then, what'd you want from me?
Was it worth
it? The older I get, the better I taste. Everybody, what can I say? It's like wine, baby.
Did something special happen then, or am I just...
My whole life is special, because I'm still alive doing what I want to... do with who I want to do it with. To me, I'm not living in the past because I'm living in the present. It's in New York. Get used to it. It has never changed. It had a golden moment here. Probably had a golden moment in the 40s, too. I'm not sure. I wasn't here. Maybe the 60s. We weren't here.
So it was all bullshit?
No, none of it was bullshit. It happens when it happens, and things change, and time is not what it once was, and it isn't anywhere. If you've done one thing, you're living in the past, and that's your glory day, that's your glory day. This is my glory day. I'm here talking to you eating octopus. I got my boots on his knees.
And I'm like it.
And if only his was big enough, he'd be f***ing me now, but we're going to go have a cigarette. Got that? Thank you.
We'll be back. Sit up, boy.
I try to make paintings that are so beautiful that I get lost in them while I'm doing them. And we just hope that other people get lost in it the same way.
You know, I have a John Lurie over my bed.
Well, you posted about it. That was nice that you posted that. And sometimes, you know, you get these letters and stuff. It's like, your painting saved my life, da-da-da.
Yeah.
But then sometimes, because I don't have any shows...
Ah, oh, that's great.
It feels pathetic, you know?
Well, this is incredible to me.
What?
You don't have shows.
That's
regularly.
Insane, and it's sick, and it's wrong, and I don't even want to complain about it. You complain.
I'm complaining about it.
Yeah, okay.
I am bitter.
Because I'm going to die one day, and they're going to be worth a lot of money.
Right.
So my paintings are going to be on the same TV station as Wolf Blitzer.
Oh, they are. Yes.
This is just really a breakthrough for me.
He's a big art fan.
He is not. How I came to New York is like I was kind of like on this Coltrane thing. I wanted to find God through music. I started meeting all these amazing people. They were irreverent. The energy was enormous. And it was probably more fun than anybody's ever had in human history for about a year or two. But there was no discipline, which, I mean, I like people who can play their instrument like they just found it on the street.
Mm-hmm.
But they can't just do it once. They gotta work on it. I mean, I was a serious saxophone player. I came here as a saxophone player. I had to hide the fact that I...
I know, right?
I had to hide. I mean, I really did. I would practice for 2 hours every day, but I would, like, I wouldn't tell people. So, these are eggs, which you could get, you know, at the store. If you live in a good neighborhood, they will even deliver them to your house. And then you take water, which... I know you go to all these exotic places, but they used to say that New York had the best water.
That is true.
You think it's still true?
I haven't heard anything to say otherwise.
Do you drink it?
Yeah, I do.
And then you boil them. And then I serve them to you.
Outstanding. I am grateful and honored.
Well, I'm really curious because I've seen your show and I watch you sit down. You eat like some mouse head soup and then you go, it's delicious. Just curious to see when you eat the hard-boiled egg if you're going to say this is delicious.
As long as there's not like half-term chicken fetus in there, which wouldn't be the first time today, by the way, I'll be thrilled.
We really felt like the universe was between... Houston and 14th Street and Bowery and Avenue C, you know? And if you went outside there, you were a phony. You were a traitor. It's like, we're done with you. Might as well be an accountant.
What about film? I mean, as it turned out, you ended up appearing in work by Miss Poe, Jim Jarmusch, all very seminal films.
And I made my own. I made my own films, too. But it was kind of just like, you go downstairs, you run into a friend, you want to get a cup of coffee, and then... That's, you know what I mean? Like, there's nothing to it. And everybody's making these movies, and so do a little music for that. I act in that one, and I'll hold the boom on that one. You know, like, I didn't think about it that much, you know?
Right.
And so
Look at that. I'm not eating this shit. There's a plate.
Thank you. Eggs, the perfect food. Thank you, sir.
Eat that. I don't think I've ever cooked for anybody before.
Well, I'm honored, sir. So looking back, is there a danger of over-romanticizing that place and that time, given the downside and the body count?
I don't know. Does it have to end badly? I mean, I'm glad I survived it. I'm glad I still got my own liver. I'm glad I lived through it. But it's kind of, I don't know how to add that up. Mm-hmm. I'm sure glad I didn't miss it.
Doesn't pay to try. All the smart boys know why. Doesn't mean I didn't try. I just never know why.
Say the egg was delicious.
It's, oh, no,
you did
right.
Not.
But I ate two of them. Silence is the highest compliment. Well, just the gnashing of my jaws on those delicious, delicious eggs.
You can now watch CNN's Five Things on Max. Each weekday, Kate Baldwin breaks down the five essential news stories in 5 minutes or less. She'll get you up to speed and on with your day. CNN's Five Things with Kate Baldwin, streaming weekdays exclusively on Max.